We get to Camelot today. Camelot being that descriptor that was often employed by the U.S. press to describe the situation in Washington after John Fitzgerald Kennedy became president of the United States with his lovely wife, Jacqueline née Bouvier Kennedy, who introduced a type of style, a grace, if you will, an elegance into the White House via the unofficial office of the First Lady. We'll talk a little bit about the romanticism that accompanied the Kennedy administration, more so the Kennedy family, who in many ways symbolized the hope and aspirations of the baby boomer generation. He had this young, relatively young, vibrant president and his elegant wife and small children now leading the United States in the aftermath of World War II. And indeed, Kennedy had checked off all of the requisite requirements of being a president on a curriculum vitae. Like Woodrow Wilson, he was an Ivy League grad. He hadn't served as a president of any Ivy League institution, but he was a Harvard grad. And he considered both Roosevelts to be political heroes of his. He shaped his life along the lines of Theodore and his political career and ideology more along the lines of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But before we get to that, let's discuss more about the 1950s and the Eisenhower years. Left out talking about the intoxicating innovation of television and how it dominated American life in the 1950s. And beyond looking at the television, we assessed the effects of suburban sprawl and the accompanying white flight from urban areas. Note that the effect of white flight was not just the effect that it had a cultural demographic effect on the population centers of urban cities, urban environments within the United States. Whites, especially outside of ethnic enclaves, moved a lot of their capital out of urban centers at this time. But it would be a gradual process by which suburbs became the go-to places to live and the choice places in which to inhabit. For example, Detroit, Michigan. Detroit, Michigan in the 1950s and 60s is not the Detroit, Michigan that you know today. The Detroit, Michigan that you pass through and probably speed through on your way to Ontario. It wasn't a hobbled out former industrial center. It was, in fact, by 1964, so this is why I'm emphasizing the gradual nature of urban decline, especially in the Rust Belt cities in the old Midwest. In 1964, Detroit, Michigan, not Washington, D.C., not Pensacola, Florida, not New Orleans, Louisiana, or Chicago, Illinois, but Detroit, Michigan had the highest per capita income of any major metropolitan area in the United States. That's amazing. That's amazing. What's even more amazing is to analyze the precipitous decline of that city and the formula by which that took place. People, if they were moving out of Detroit and into the suburbs, or if they weren't moving to the Detroit suburbs like Grosse Pointe or Auburn Hills, some of them were moving out to the South and the West, because the South and the West became industrialized in the 1950s and offered opportunities in large part because corporations were relocating their manufacturing centers to the South and the West, where what institution wasn't as prevalent as in the northern climes? Paul? Unions, that's right. And indeed, unions take on a different nature within the 1950s, because there was general contentment with the prosperity of the age and the economic boom that accompanied, more so came in the aftermath, or after glow, if you will, of World War II. Well, unions decided to more so cooperate, not just with corporations that they were working with and collectively bargaining with, but also with other unions. The American Federation of Labor, or AFL, joined with the CIO. And to this day, those are two major unions that are combined with one another rather than competing for the allegiance and membership of, for example, in this case, auto and industrial workers or shop workers in the case of the AFL-CIO. About countercultural reactions to all this, especially to consumerism, we had the Beat Movement, which was headed by what two men are most mentioned in regard to the Beat Movement, both in the film Happy Days, but also within the text, the Murren text. Paul? Jack Kerouac, famous work on the road, right? And it's in these adventures as a beatnik, poet, and writer that he tried to crush the prevailing attitudes and dispositions of American society, keeping up with the Joneses, consumerism, stuff of that nature, conformity, whether that be in terms of fashion or musical preference or tastes or even other institutions, like, for example, marriage that was expected of most people once they got into their even early to mid 20s. It is remarkable to note that in the 1950s, 97%, get that, 97% of those who were of marrying age were indeed married in the United States. 97%. That's an incredible figure, especially when you compare it today, where the marriage rate is around 35 to 40% of married age. So we're talking about from about 20 years or 21 years of age through 35 years of age. Only about 35 to 40% of Americans are married within that time period today, right? And it's especially hard because a lot of those people are living in their basements. So how do you, you know, ask a woman or a guy out when you're living in your parents' basement? You know, what do you say? Come check out my bachelor pad in my parents' basement. We can play PlayStation or something like that. No, it's kind of embarrassing. Yes, Haley? No. Oh, no, no, no. Divorce, as was mentioned in the Happy Days piece via the Century series from ABC, people looked at divorce as an inherent and incredible failure. And oftentimes people who were divorced were ostracized from the various communities in which they lived. It was seen as an anomaly, very abnormal occurrence at this time. All right. Other questions about that? Good. John Kenneth Galbraith, he was mentioned on several occasions within your Murren reading. He is important in the sense that he highlights some problems with what he saw constituted 1950s economics, American society and culture. And he did so in his famous work called The Affluent Society. And he was particularly poignant in his attack on consumerism and railed against the income inequality that was sometimes present, especially in urban areas, wherein you had a burgeoning and developing middle and upper class, whereas it seemed as though still, even within the 1950s, from Galbraith's point of view, the poor was left behind. In truth, however, in the 1950s and 60s, all economic real wages, all real wages of income earners rose and rose greatly within this period of time. So it wasn't as if the lower or poorer classes were left behind within this economic boom. Noah?
I think in the Century series,
yes,
movie, you mentioned that the lower 50% had incomes that were rising faster than like the very rich.
Indeed,
how did America come, like, get from a very prosperous middle class to today where people are concerned about the shrinking middle class?
A couple of things there. Relative to other nations, the United States middle class is incredibly large, and it is rather well off. A couple of things that Galbraith ridiculed were dealt with public policy, namely how, for example, with Eisenhower, you see this precipitous decline in upper marginal tax rates. And that was only natural because during World War II, they had advanced to World War I levels of 71%. I mean, you have to, again, we saw the effects of what occurs when you increase taxes on the rich to that degree. It causes stagnation. The fuel or juice of credit to a capitalistic economy dries up. Galbraith saw that as a cause of, whereas, as you stated, statistically, the poor, in terms of real wages, saw their wages go up and they were enjoying more relative prosperity than ever before. From Galbraith's point of view, the situation or the condition of the rich and the upper middle class had, by degree, improved at a much greater rate, not because necessarily their real wages or salaries were going up at the same level or at the same speed, but rather that the tax burden was going down. So therefore, they were paying less for government programs that Galbraith, as a progressive — he was a progressive, he was a leftist — that he advocated for. So Galbraith, while he would champion and applaud Eisenhower keeping Social Security around, and other programs like some housing programs that were left as residual programs from the New Deal. He did, that is to say Eisenhower, defund things like the TVA and other alphabet soup programs from the New Deal. So really in the 1950s, you have this, I guess I would call it moderate conservatism. I can't think of a better descriptor than that. Eisenhower was a moderate conservative to the extent when he was questioned, well, if you're the reincarnation, political reincarnation of Harding and Coolidge, why don't you get rid of Social Security? I mean, that's an entitlement program, right? And he said, good luck. His response was to any sort of hardline conservative like a Barry Goldwater or someone like that who is emerging within Arizona, who is a true sort of hardline old school conservative. And he would ridicule the Eisenhower administration for not rolling back all of these government programs and expenditures. He would say, yeah, good luck. If you want to get the party, in fact, Eisenhower's quote was, I might be paraphrasing here, but I think it's a direct quote, the party that gets rid of Social Security is the party that will be dead in a year. So he understood that people liked Social Security, despite its inefficiencies and despite the fact that, sorry, that you're probably, if you've already been employed, even to a small measure, you're never going to see those benefits. I'm probably not going to see them. You're definitely not going to see them. So plan appropriately. Good. Also, I hate to sidetrack here, but the CBO, or what does CBO stand for? Do you know? Congressional Budget Office. Just last week came out with a report that said by the 2030s, the United States is going to experience a fiscal nightmare like that of Argentina or Greece, unless something drastic is done. And the CBO is even accounting for economic growth at an average of 1.9%, but the debt burden is going to exceed, the debt to GDP ratio is going to exceed that of the United States in the aftermath of World War II. And unless we have something like the Internet 2.0, right, to inspire the economy and make it grow and produce new jobs and opportunities and productivity and productive sectors for the economy, this is no good, right? So, again, the commentators that I was listening to on the radio and the podcast, because I don't really listen to too much terrestrial radio anymore, and when I do, it's, as you know, AM stations. So anyway, old loser. But I was listening to a podcast, and then basically this guy from Forbes, he runs Barron's. He's an editor for Barron's, the economic magazine. And he essentially said, well, what's going to happen then is they're just going to do what we've already known is a prescription for when governments are in debt, and that is print more money. So inflate the dollar. So if you inflate the dollar to that degree, however, we're in a situation of Weimar Germany after World War I. Get your wheelbarrows ready to go buy a loaf of bread. Sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings, but this is U.S. history after all. Okay? But we're going to talk about Camelot soon. So there is this glorious romanticism about that. So we'll try to balance all of the gloomy pessimism out. Let's talk about politics in the 1950s. The election of 1952... we sort of covered already to a great extent. The major concern was the Red Scare coming to a resolution for the War of Korea. What Americans wanted were alternative means by which to either contain or roll back communism, alternatives to actually sending off thousands and tens of thousands of American men and boys to go and fight in these proxy wars. And this is essentially what Eisenhower promised and he delivered upon. His opponent was actually from Illinois, Adlai Stevenson. I always think it's kind of cute that the man, i.e. the president, who was most responsible and the Congresses that were most responsible for bringing about the Interstate Highway Act of 1956, creating the interstate highway system in the United States, were Eisenhower and Stevenson, who was in the Illinois Senate at the time. And in Chicago, what should happen, the two closest highways to one another are the Eisenhower and the Stevenson, even though they were political rivals. Because Stevenson will secure the Democratic nomination in 52 and 56, but he's going to play the role in our own little American presidential musical. Get that reference to Josephine and there's the Intoxicated Dreamcoat coming up. All right, our own little U.S. presidential history musical of Henry Clay or William Jennings Bryan. Always the bridesmaid, never the bride. Sorry, Annalee Stephenson. A thing about Stephenson, too, and this is something that Republicans should have noted, Eisenhower was no looker, right? He was not an attractive guy, but Annalee Stephenson was downright ugly, all right? He had this gigantic bulbous head. He looked like an alien. He had very little hair. He tried to comb it over from about this region all the way over. Just not a good-looking guy. Very smart, very bright, but just not presidential material, given the fact that he looked like he was from Venus. Okay, so anyway, Eisenhower wins in the first round. We have McCarthyism transpire. Interesting to note here, there's been a lot of revisionism about Joseph McCarthy's career. He was an alcoholic. He was abrasive. And McCarthyism was a real thing. It did instill fear in various elements of American society, most notably Hollywood, in the government. But ultimately, he fell on his own petard, his sword, when he went after the U.S. Army during the Korean War. Considering that, from the perspective of McCarthy, there were subversive elements within the generals and within the officer corps, but there was very little evidence to substantiate that. And when the hearings went public and were actually televised, well, people saw what an abrasive and caustic character he was, and eventually he lost his Senate seat. He died in 1957 of chronic alcoholism. That being said, about the revisionism of McCarthyism, he accused at one point Secretary of State under Truman, Dean Acheson, of harboring 205 known communists within the State Department, which is sort of counterproductive when your existential enemy is the Soviet Union. You don't want the Harry Hopkins or the Henry Wallaces of the world being part of the State Department. Well, yes, he hyperbolized in the end the number, but as it turns out, there were 57 confirmed communists and Soviet sympathizers within the U.S. State Department under Harry Truman. So while, yeah, the 205 number is too high, I think the 57 number is still too high. It should be zero, right? It should be zero. But in any case, this is part of the State Department. So McCarthy wasn't totally wrong in going after subversive elements, or at least believing that they were part of the upper echelons of government. So that's McCarthy. I want to put off talking about civil rights for a moment, because while it was the subject matter that you had to prep for and we were planning on talking about today, let's get through to Camelot and to the early years of Kennedy, and then look back at civil rights as a true movement that really began in the late 1940s with the Truman administration, and then continued through the Eisenhower years, famously, of course, highlighted in many ways by Rosa Parks, and then also the Montgomery bus boycott, and then beyond that, the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. Okay, we'll talk about that, and the highly controversial reading that you had from Woods, right? I mean, of all of the readings that you had from Woods, that's the most incendiary, right? But I want you to temper or think about whether we should temper that the incendiary or controversial nature of that reading by considering that he's not commenting on the overall beneficial, positive nature of the civil rights movement as it was an organic social movement. He's criticizing government action during it. So that's one thing I'm going to stress when we take a look at Woods further, most likely tomorrow, given our shortened periods. He's taking a look at governmental and bureaucratic action during it, not the movement itself. The movement itself is, I think, without critique, it's arguing for racial justice. And so long as it was nonviolent and it was nonetheless passionate, it was an incredible success, especially when we compare it to the previous two civil rights movements, right? The previous two civil rights movements, Reconstruction, it worked for a while, but in the end it was a failure with the Compromise of 1877. And then beyond that, the second civil rights movement, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, yeah, there were some gains there. I mean, Booker T. got invited to the White House after all. So there was at least a conversation about Black and minority rights within the United States. But it's the 1950s and 1960s civil rights movement, spearheaded by men like Dr. Martin Luther King, later a more militant Malcolm X, and others, Jesse Jackson, Julian Bond, and other leaders that really brought about the civil rights revolution. Okay, but remember with Woods, he's just talking about the government action there. And, I kind of get excited about talking about that reading because there's a lot of feedback I get, and I like feedback. All right, I like to get your opinions on things. When Zora Neale Hurston says, basically what Brown said is that someone who doesn't want to sit next to me is going to be mandated to sit next to me, right? And how is that equality? Or how is that a good thing? It's kind of amazing. Anyway, we'll put that off for a moment. Let's talk about Eisenhower domestic policy, especially Eisenhower domestic economic policy. He was true to his word and his campaign promises. In the 1950s, the United States runs balanced budgets. The federal government only spends what it takes in terms of revenue. Now, one problem with that, however, as much as those of us on the right side of the political spectrum might applaud that the federal government is actually running balanced budgets, unheard of within your lifetime, actually, and it's not creating more debt, two problems here. First, the economy or the federal government has had to service the debt accrued during the Great Depression and then World War II, which is more than substantial. It's considerable. Beyond that, so that's an anchor on the economy. It's a drag on the economy, which is otherwise running pretty boisterously. But beyond that, with balanced budgets, that doesn't mean that governmental revenue went down. Now, here's the phenomenon of what we call the Laffer curve. This is named after Arthur Laffer, who was an economic advisor to the Reagan administration. This is something that was referred to in the 1920s when Andrew Mellon did the same thing in lowering upper marginal tax rates, right? How is it, tell me, by lowering the tax rates in the 1950s, as the Eisenhower administration and the Congresses did in that decade, from 71 to 25 down to 23 at one point, how did more revenue actually come into the federal government? People are being taxed at a lesser percentage, and yet more revenue is coming in. Noah?
Taxed on consumption. No,
they're being taxed on income. There's no national sales tax, right? This is an income tax. Right. So think of the dynamic. You tax someone, right, who's earning at 70%, $10,000, but you tax someone who's later on making $100,000 at 25%, where are you making more money? The latter example, right? And so revenue actually increased to the federal government, and that was needed because of the incredible military expenditure that was advocated for by NSC 68, and that document would be, in a sense, the leitmotif, the theme, or provide the structure for the State Department and the American military going forward. He did work and campaign against old New Deal programs, but he gave in on others, as I mentioned, for example, Social Security. The Interstate Highway Act of 1956 put a lot of people to work, that's true. It did encourage immense expenditure in infrastructure and knit the country together in a variety of ways. Ways that, for example, television and other media hadn't been able to do. In all, $27 billion was used as part of a loan program for the building of highways. This is a federal undertaking. We are a long way, and I would love to go back. Maybe someone could do a major paper on this dissertation. Eileen, you'd be perfect for this. Okay. When you go off to school, love to go back in the congressional debates on this bill and see if James Madison was even mentioned, or the Constitution even mentioned. Because after all, where does it say in the Constitution that the federal government has the right to build extensive highway road systems? It can build postal roads, but these are not postal roads. These roads, in fact, are designed not just to be conveyances or means by which travel can be done more extensively throughout the country, Holiday Inns springing up and the like, but also all the viaducts were set, that is to say the bridges over the highways, at a minimum height. You know why? Because missile systems had to go underneath them and be conveyed very quickly in the event of a Cold War outbreak. Okay? That's all our time today, isn't that? Am I right? Or do I have 10 minutes? I have 10 minutes. Oh, golden. All right. So wait a second. 4, 5. Yeah, 10 minutes. Okay, so stay tuned. Sorry about that. So yeah, isn't that, that's a scary thought, isn't it? That the government mandated all these private contractors to build these bridges and overpasses at a minimal height because the missile systems that had been developed by the Pentagon needed to be expedited from coast to coast very quickly in the case of a nuclear fallout. Wow. Or Cold War outbreak, as I said. The Cold War turning very hot in that case. All right. So this facilitated commerce, too. By the way, without the Interstate Highway Act, a couple of things. We wouldn't have a trucking industry. The major way in which commodities and goods are conveyed, in fact, nearly all the things that you're wearing, carrying with you, even having your possession at home, are conveyed to you by truck, right? And that didn't become feasible until the creation of this interstate highway system. So another thing I would like to look at, whether in the debate of the bill in 1956, anyone mentioned James Madison. Remember the bonus bill? How James Madison vetoed the bonus bill in 1819, saying, as much as this is a good idea that you want to build a federal road linking Kentucky with the eastern markets, it's not constitutional, so I'm vetoing it, right? Did anyone even give a pause to the very writer of the Constitution saying that this is unconstitutional? I doubt it, right? We're living in a different world here. We're living in a different world, certainly a different country. Furthermore, how many people in the trucking industry were lobbying for this? Essentially, if you were an owner of a trucking company, you would benefit incredibly from the building of federal roads that, for all intents and purposes, were free, right? Unless the state was building other thoroughfares and tributaries from those are free roads. You could travel on I-80 all you want to your heart's content, right? But go on 88, which is more built by the state of Illinois, and look out. You got to pay that, what is it, $4 thing at Dixon, which is unfair, really, because that was Ronald Reagan's birthplace. You shouldn't have to pay a toll on a road and Ronald Reagan's birthplace. He'd be rolling over his grave. Okay, so we digressed a little bit more here. How about foreign policy? What was the nickname of Eisenhower's foreign policy, chiefly authored by his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, who, by the way, was a bigwig in the Wilson administration? See how these guys stick around? They're like chameleons. Once you're in the State Department, all of a sudden your politics can change very rapidly with who's in power because you need a job. John Foster Dulles was the chief architect of the Versailles clauses that gave all the war guilt to Germany. Great job, John Foster Dulles, because through that, you just engendered greater German hatred that would lead to World War II. But anyway, he still got a job in the Eisenhower administration. Oops, I almost tried to get onto Mr. Holmberg's classes. That'd be interesting, as he's talking about aggregate demand and all of a sudden Ike and Dick show up. All right. So, okay. So the nickname? What was the nickname? Ethan. The New Look. Remember I said beware of presidential agendas that always start with new, okay? The New Look, the New Deal, the New Frontier. And then LBJ decides to change it all up and says, we can't go with new anymore because new is old, ironically, paradoxically. We have to go with great from that point on. Great society. Great. So the New Look in foreign policy, the idea here was it wasn't sufficient from this point of view to simply contain communism as the Truman Doctrine and George Kennan's Long Telegram had advocated. No, the United States needs to roll back communistic gains in areas of Eastern Europe, in Southeast Asia, and the like. This would require further military expenditure. Dulles said that it was the mission, by its very nature, of the United States to liberate captive peoples by ensuring that they had a chance at representative government and what he termed as a liberal democracy. So it was the United States acting as a police officer and policeman for the world. Think of Teddy Roosevelt here. But rather with arcane Rooseveltian goals and objectives in mind of the United States enforcing its will upon other nations, it just simply wanted to ensure that those nations had a choice, and that choice was American liberal democracy with a constitution a written system of government that would almost always resemble the U.S. Constitution. And of course, that state which the CIA would ultimately have to intervene, whether it was in Guatemala in the 1950s or Iran, which causes a huge amount of problems, or in Southeast Asia in this little state which is called Vietnam within French Indochina. Well, if through elections, it looks as though there's going to be a left-leaning regime coming to power that might cozy up to the Soviet Union, then the CIA is going to spring right into action, subvert those free elections, so much for liberal democracy, right? Overthrow those left-leaning regimes and put in place and ensconce pro-American regimes in their place. Because people love that. People love that. This is very myopic, short-sighted foreign policy, I would argue. It causes disastrous consequences by which we're still dealing with those things today. It's not just that Iranians are existentially opposed to America to the point in which every Iranian boy or girl, when they're born, has a little sign coming out of the womb that says, America's the great Satan, death to America. It's been a long history in which the United States has meddled in Iranian politics and its own autonomy and sovereignty. And that's why there's this great hatred toward the United States. These things don't just come about. Don't believe the George W. Bush line. They hate us because of our freedom. What the fuck is that? Who says that? Right? They hate our way of life. Well, yes, I suppose Al-Qaeda hates Western ways of life, right? But Al-Qaeda wouldn't even exist if your father didn't send American troops to Saudi Arabia in 1990 and 1991. So anyway, I'm getting off on a soapbox, but just be aware of all this. Remember I said that Americans were concerned about containing communism. They were all in favor of that, even rolling back communist gains when the Dulles administration and the Eisenhower administration more generally talked about these things, but they weren't willing to send off troops and tens of thousands of American troops to do so. So Eisenhower and the State Department worked up what's called the Strategic Air Command. In other words, the major deterrent to continual aggression from the Soviet Union and communist sectors around the globe would be massive American air power through conventional bombing, but also the deliverance of nuclear, atomic, and hydrogen payloads at this time. So that was SAC, or Strategic Air Command. In 1953, Stalin died. That's a good thing. He was a mass murderer, right? And he was a very hardliner toward the United States. Even more hardline when he realized that pretty much the Roosevelt, Truman, to a lesser degree, Eisenhower administrations would give him whatever he wanted as long as he demanded it and made sure his mustache was neatly groomed. Because remember, that mustache is evil, right? Remember last year, the Tournament of Bad? Stalin's mustache? Okay, sorry. It was an inside AP Euro joke. All right. Actually, someone showed me, I think it was Ian Kroll, a picture of young Stalin. He was good looking. He really was. Old Stalin was pockmarked and bad mustache, Ditka comb back hair, not so attractive. But young Stalin was a good looking dude. Of course, he probably doesn't get a lot of chicks in bars when he comes up to him and said, are you part of the worldwide revolution or something like that? That's not a good opening line. Hello would have worked better. Okay, Khrushchev. Khrushchev succeeds Stalin as the premier. What's amazing is Khrushchev sort of opened the books on what atrocities Stalin had committed. This was novel. So this openness indicated to the United States that maybe Khrushchev is someone as a Soviet premier with whom we could deal. So the Eisenhower administration immediately made overtures to Khrushchev. And one of those overtures was the open skies overture. The idea that not the military would shoot down any spy planes from the other, and that through having open skies, each power would be able to determine the nuclear and technological and military capabilities of the other. Khrushchev said no thanks, right? Said no thanks. And that's going to lead to problems in 1959. But note the overture. So things are becoming a little bit warmer, cooler. I never know the degree or temperature, but they're becoming better and less tense within the Cold War. Tomorrow, Camelot. If it wasn't shortened periods, we would have gotten to Kennedy today. Sorry about that. So Camelot and civil rights, keep reading. I know it's an aggressive schedule, but it's all necessary. As you guys are leaving too, just one administrative point. I will post this on Schoology, but the SAS book is a neat little summary to help you out with your decades projects. So this is very helpful and beneficial should you access that for your decades projects. Okay, guys. God love you. See you later. See you, Monica. Maria, great job on the DBQ. Did you see the...